For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got a right royal special. Coming up in today's show, we'll find out about the history of coronations from author Lucinda Gosling. We'll hear some books about and books written by the royal family, including one narrated by King Charles himself. And I chat to Lady Glenconner about her life in the shadow of the crown. But before we get all regal, here's Lynn Livingstone with her weekly roundup of what's new in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Our first book this week is the best-selling cosy crime novel Murder Before Evensong by broadcaster and vicar Richard Coles. This is the first in a new series and was donated to us by Orion.
Canon Daniel Clement, AKC, rector of Chanton St Mary's, stood in his pulpit looking down on his parishioners. His text was taken from the Book of Numbers, the story of the Israelites turning against Moses, for leading them not into the promised land, but into a wilderness. A resonant story, not only for him, but he felt sure, for all 58 of his predecessors, for flocks then and now were apt to turn.
Canon Daniel Clement is rector of Champton. He has been there for 8 years, living at the rectory alongside his widowed mother, opinionated, fearless, ever so slightly annoying Audrey, and his two dogs, Cosmo and Hilda. When Daniel announces a plan to install a lavatory in church, the parish is suddenly and unexpectedly divided. As lines are drawn in the community, long-buried secrets come dangerously close to destroying the apparent calm of Champton. And then Anthony Bonus, cousin to Bernard de Flores, patron of Champton, is found dead at the back of the church, stabbed in the neck with a pair of secateurs. As the police moves in and the bodies start piling up, Daniel Clement is the only one who can try and keep his fractured community together and catch a killer.
Moses averts mutiny by striking a rock, and a cataract of water miraculously pours forth so his thirsty and restive people may drink, a resourceful tactic that suited Daniel's purposes too. Like Moses and the footsore of Israel, he preached, we too must learn to live in hope, to look to the future, and to find in our present circumstances the resources to meet its challenge. As Moses struck the rock of Meribah, and lo, a crystal stream poured forth, we too must allow new waters to flow, or rather, to flush. My dear people, we need to install a lavatory.
Murder Before Evensong is written and read by Richard Coles, and lasts 7 hours, 25 minutes.
Next up is the autobiography of the charming Hollywood actor and New Zealand winemaker, Sam Neill. It's called Did I Ever Tell You This? And was given to the library by Penguin Random House.
When my youngest daughter, Elena, was small and at a new school of some kind, I didn't like any of them much, the teacher asked the circle of little children around her, what does your mummy or your daddy do for a job? The little hands went up in the air, and the answers flew thick and fast. My mummy's a lawyer. My daddy's an accountant. My mummy builds houses, and so on. When it came to Elena, the answer about me was both perceptive and entirely accurate. My daddy sits in caravans. Yes, it's true. That's what I've done much of my life, sit in caravans, or trailers, as they say in the USA.
In this unexpected memoir, written in a creative burst of just a few months in 2022, Sam Neill tells the story of how he became one of the world's most celebrated actors, who has worked with everyone from Meryl Streep to Isabella Gianni, from Jeff Goldblum to Sean Connery, from Steven Spielberg to Jane Campion. By his own account, his career has been a series of unpredictable turns of fortune. Born in 1947 in Northern Ireland, he emigrated to New Zealand at the age of 7. His family settled in Dunedin on the South Island, but young Sam was sent away to boarding school in Christchurch, where he was hopeless at sports and discovered he enjoyed acting. But how do you become an actor in New Zealand in the 1960s and 70s where there is no film industry? After university, he made documentary films while also appearing in the occasional amateur productions of Shakespeare. In 1977, he took the lead in Sleeping Dogs, the first feature made in New Zealand in more than a decade, a project that led to a major role in Gillian Anderson's celebrated My Brilliant Career. And after that, Sam Neill found his way, sometimes by accident, into his own brilliant career. He has worked around the world, an actor who has moved effortlessly from blockbuster to art house to TV, from Dr. Alan Grant in the Jurassic Park movies to The Piano and Peaky Blinders. Did I Ever Tell You This is a joy to listen to, a marvellous and often very funny book, the work of a natural storyteller who is a superb observer of other people and who writes with love and warmth about his family. It is also his account of his life outside film, especially in central Otago, where he established two paddocks, his vineyard famous for its Pinot Noir.
Sitting, waiting for someone to tell me what to do, somewhere near a film set. I used to sit and read the paper, or sometimes even the script. Nowadays, I stare at my iPhone looking for enlightenment. It's never there. Once in a while, there's a knock on the door, and the assistant to someone's assistant, who is an assistant to someone else, might kindly ask you if you'd like a cup of tea. Of course I would. If you're really lucky, they might even bring you lunch, but that would be the assistant to the first assistant who brought you tea. When Elena would visit me at work, that is what I would be doing, sitting in a trailer, in a car park somewhere, having a cuppa, waiting. Her daddy at work.
Did I Ever Tell You This is written and read by Sam Neill and lasts 12 hours, 36 minutes.
RNIB Library have finally acquired the much requested One August Night by Victoria Hislop. This is the long-awaited follow-up to the beloved novel The Island, and it was donated to us by Headline Publishing.
For some women, pregnancy is a period of good health and joyful expectation, but for Anna van der Lerkes, it was a time of misery and nausea. The doctors insisted that she was confined to her bed for the first 3 months, telling her that it was the only way to save the baby. During these interminable weeks, she lost her vitality along with her porcelain-smooth complexion and her long, glossy curls, which fell out in handfuls. Once the obstetrician had confirmed that the pregnancy was stable, Anna's husband, Andreas, invited all the estate workers to enjoy a glass of his best wine. More than 100 of them gathered in front of the house in the Elowinda Hills to toast the forthcoming baby. Everyone was aware that the arrival of an heir was long overdue, and the continuing health and prosperity of such a vast estate as owned by the van der Lerkes family was dependent on the continuation of the line.
The 25th of August, 1957. The island of Spinalonga closes its leper colony. And a moment of violence has devastating consequences. When time stops dead for Maria Petrakis and her sister Anna, two families splinter apart, and for the people of Plaka, the closure of Spinalonga is forever coloured with tragedy. In the aftermath, the question of how to resume life looms large. Stigma and scandal need to be confronted, and somehow for those impacted, a future built from the ruins of the past. Number one best-selling author Victoria Hislop returns to the world and characters she created in The Island, the award-winning novel that remains one of the best-selling reading group novels of the century. It is finally time to be reunited with Anna, Maria, Manolis and Andreas in the weeks leading up to the evacuation of the island and beyond.
It was a matter of concern to them all that Andreas and Anna van der Lerkes should produce some offspring. Anna did not make an appearance. Instead, she watched through the fine gauze of her bedroom curtains, noting that her husband's cousin Manolis was the first to arrive and the last to leave. She could not take her eyes off him, even for a moment, and was certain that he regularly glanced up towards her. Even this did not allay her greatest fear, that he had forgotten her.
One August Night by Victoria Hislop is narrated by Amelia Fox and lasts for 8 hours 24 minutes.
Sebastian Barry is a multi-award-winning author of literary fiction. His latest, Old God's Time, was donated by Faber & Faber.
Sometime in the 60s, old Mr. Tomalty had put up an incongruous lean-to addition to his Victorian castle. It was a granny flat of modest size, but with some nice touches befitting a putative relative. The carpentry, at least, was excellent, and one wall was encased in something called beauty board, its veneer capturing light and mutating it into soft, brown darknesses. This premises, with its little echoing bedroom, its tiny entrance hall, a few hundred books still in their boxes, and his two old gun cases from his army days, was where Tom Kettle had, in his own words, washed up.
Recently retired policeman Tom Kettle is settling into the quiet of his new home, a lean-to annexed to a Victorian castle overlooking the Irish Sea. For months he has barely seen a soul, catching only glimpses of his eccentric landlord and a nervous young mother who has moved in next door. Occasionally fond memories return of his family, his beloved wife June, and their two children. But when two former colleagues turn up at his door with questions about a decades-old case, one which Tom never quite came to terms with, he finds himself pulled into the darkest currents of his past.
The books remembering, if sometimes these days he did not, his old interests. The history of Palestine, of Malaya, old Irish legends, discarded gods, a dozen random matters that at one time or another he had stuck his inquisitive nose into. The stirring sound of the sea below the picture window had been the initial allure, but everything about the place pleased him. The mock Gothic architecture, including the pointless castellation on the roof line, the square of hedges in the garden that provided a windbreak and a sun trap, the broken granite jetties on the shoreline, the island skulking in the near distance, even the crumbling sewerage pipes sticking out into the water. The placid tidal pools reminded him of the easily fascinated child he once had been 60 years ago. The distant calling of today's children playing in their invisible gardens giving a sort of vaguely tormenting counterpoint. Vague torment was his forte, he thought. The sheeting rain, the sheeting sunlight, the poor heroes of fishermen trying to bring their rowing boats back against the ferocious current into the little cutstone harbour as neat and nice as anything in New Ross where he had worked as a very young policeman. It all seemed delightful to him. Even now in winter, when winter was only interested in its own unfriendly harshness.
Old God's Time by Sebastian Barry is narrated by Stephen Hogan and lasts 8 hours 35 minutes. And Lynn will be back at the same time next week with more new books from RNIB. And we'll have Lucinda Gosling on The History of Coronations after this.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
As the coronation of King Charles III approaches, we're taking a look back at royal coronations in history. And who better to speak to than an expert royal historian? We're joined now by author and historian Lucinda Gosling. Lucinda, thanks for speaking to us today.
Pleasure. Hello.
For most people watching on May the 6th, this will be their first coronation. What can they expect?
Well, they can expect something quite magnificent. It may not be quite as magnificent as the coronation that took place for the King's mother in 1953. There's been a lot of publicity from the palace itself to say that this will be a more pared-down coronation. But I think that despite that, I think what we'll be seeing is history in action. We'll be seeing a lot of pageantry, some wonderful costumes. Obviously, the crown jewels will be out and in action rather than sitting behind glass in the Tower of London. It will be a shorter ceremony than past coronations. But as you said, there's very few people now who will remember 1953 coronation. So I think to compare would be silly, really. I think we can expect something quite spectacular and very interesting to witness.
And how has that ceremony changed across history? Would it be recognisable to monarchs from hundreds of years ago?
It would, actually. And I think that is what is very significant about the coronation, is it is probably the closest we would get to medieval ceremonial ritual. And there are lots of key elements of coronations which, you know, go back to the Middle Ages, which they might recognise in a present day coronation. They will be at the very core of that. So it will be elements like the anointing of the king, which is the most sacred moment, where oil or chrism will be applied by the archbishop to the king's head and to his chest. And that, you know, that ritual goes back to even the times of the Old Testament. Obviously, the actual moment of crowning, that again, we know that even kings, English kings, before William the Conqueror, were often given a circlet or possibly a helmet to wear, not a crown. The first crown that we can see, which is recognisable, is probably on the Bayeux Tapestry worn by King Harold. So there will be that. And then there's the enthronement. So he will sit in King Edward's chair to be crowned, and then he will move onto a sort of raised platform, which I guess is raising him symbolically above the people. And that, again, is centuries old, the Vikings. Not that they had thrones necessarily, but this action of sitting higher, being placed higher than your subjects, goes back a long, long way.
And even with the precision planning involved in coronations, things can't always go as expected, can they? Are there any moments from coronations that particularly stick out as unusual?
Well, yes. I've written about this a few times, actually. There have been a few mishaps over the years. I'm sure that the king is probably well aware of these and hopes to avoid them. Obviously, 1953, Queen Elizabeth II's coronation ran like a well-oiled machine, and she was faultless in her performance. But prior to that, lots of things went wrong. Queen Victoria famously, apparently, when the coronation ring, also known as the wedding ring of England, was put on her finger, the archbishop forced it on with some sort of brutality. She had to stifle a cry of pain, and apparently afterwards she had to soak her hand in cold water to try and get it off. And then Edward VII's coronation, the archbishop there was quite elderly, quite infirm, and quite doddery on his feet. And he, when he went to pay homage to the king afterwards, which is another sort of ancient tradition where high members of the clergy and dukes will come and pay homage to the monarch afterwards. But the archbishop was unable to get up from his feet, and the king had to sort of extend his hand and help him to get up. And then I think, it was the coronation of George VI. The archbishop put his finger over a key part of the text during the coronation oath, So all these things are disastrous, you know, but probably in the great scheme of things aren't terrible. And probably the worst thing that happened was at George IV's coronation, which was the most extravagant ever known. It cost £245,000 back at the beginning of the 19th century. And there were thousands of candles, which, and this took place in July, so it was very hot. There were ladies in the abbey fainting left, right and centre, apparently. There were thousands of candles. They were all dripping hot wax onto the congregation below, who, of course, were all in their finery. And then on top of all that, the king's estranged wife, Caroline of Brunswick, demanded entry to the abbey. And the king had installed prize fighters as sort of doormen. And they would not let her in. They said, no ticket, no admission. And eventually she had to give up and go home. But it was probably quite an embarrassing scenario, I'd imagine.
So a few points there that hopefully King Charles would be able to avoid.
Let's hope so, yeah.
A lot of your work, Lucinda, has focused on the images and iconography of history. Are there common themes that link coronations throughout history? And have we seen any of those in the build-up so far to the king's coronation?
Well, I think there's things like colours. You know, I mean, when the monarch arrives at the abbey, they are dressed in red velvet, an ermine and miniver. And then when they leave, they're wearing a purple robe. And that's, you know, that's echoed, isn't it? When you see lots of, even down to publications that are coming out, purple is that sort of classic regal colour, which very much sums up the coronation. I think that, you know, the crowns, what it would be interesting to see whether there are many street decorations. That's always been quite an interesting aspect of the coronation. For the Queen's coronation, Sir Hugh Casson was engaged to be in charge of those. And what he did was around London is he would choose a different street. I think on Oxford Street, for instance, you would have shoes and hats to reflect the trades of that street. And on Whitehall, the decorations were in the forms of helmets and breastplates to reflect the household cavalry who were kept there. I mean, things like uniforms change over the centuries, but I think there is a lot of, you know, basic symbolism about, you know, those key elements of the coronation, whether that's the regalia or the colours or the people who are participants, particularly sort of the military side of things. So I think we'll see a lot of that.
And do you think that a coronation is more than just one day? Do you think that it helps to set the tone for the reign of a monarch? Have we seen that in history?
We have absolutely seen it with Queen Elizabeth II. 1953, everyone's the coronation. And because it was such a mass occasion, this was the first time it was televised. So, and eventually it was, you know, people could watch it around the world on television. The coronation of her father, George VI, was filmed, but it wasn't televised. It wasn't, you know, transmitted in the same way. So I think that, you know, there really was a kind of mass celebration and participation, even if you weren't there in the abbey. Whereas if you go back, even back to, sort of, you know, Queen Victoria, unless you're there or you're in London, you know, you can't witness it. Having said that, all around the country, you would have people celebrating. I mean, a really kind of typical thing in the late 18th and through the 19th century were towns and cities creating wonderful kind of decorated ceremonial arches and decorating public buildings. And as we, you know, as the growth of the department store happens in the late 19th century, early 20th century, places like Selfridges and Harrods would sort of swathe themselves in swags and flags and bunting and, you know, statuary. So I think that, you know, those 20th century coronations are much more memorable because of mass media. And what we have to rely on when you're going back in time are, you know, for instance, the coronation of Charles II, both John Evelyn and Samuel Pepys wrote about it. Pepys was there. He was up very high in the abbey. He couldn't see anything. And then he had to leave before the king was actually crowned because he needed to go to the toilet because he'd been there for hours. and then if you go back even further into sort of, you know, the Normans, William the Conqueror and things like that, you know, you're really relying on chroniclers and what they're saying about it and on contemporary artists. And that's, you know, the problems of that and how you know, certain monarchs are represented in art and in, you know, other media like that. So we cannot be absolutely certain that we're getting a true picture. Whereas when we're looking at 20th century coronations, we are seeing photographs. We can see what it looks like. The very first photographs of a coronation were Edward VII's, and Sir Benjamin Stone, very important photographer, he was allowed in and took a few photographs of the interior and what was happening.
And you've written a lot in your work about the history of the royal family during the last few hundred years. What is it that keeps people coming back and wanting to learn more?
I think what's interesting in the present period is there are a lot of people who aren't interested, and there is a lot of debate online and elsewhere about the relevance of the monarchy and whether we even need one anymore. But I think what is so interesting about the coronation is what we started talking about, is that thread of continuity and the fact that you can see these aspects of medieval kingship, you know, following all the way through into the 21st century. And I think that's really, really fascinating. There aren't many things that are mystical and interesting and kind of spectacular in the same way that a coronation is. And whether you're actually a royalist or not, I think to witness that and see a coronation actually happening is to, you know, as I said before, it's to witness history, isn't it? And I think that's what's so interesting. And there's lots of details, you know, some people that are interested in all the, you know, the regalia and the crowns and that sort of aspect of it. Some people will be tuning in. They just want to see what people are wearing. I mean, I'm going to be writing about what the king wears on the day, which I'm going to be quite intrigued about, because I don't think he's going, I hope to goodness he's not going to be in, you know, brocade breeches and silk stockings. I'm sure he won't be. but that's what his predecessors wore. I mean, George IV was in the most ridiculously flamboyant costume of silver and gold with rosettes and all sorts of things. He was in his late 50s and quite portly by the time he was crowned. So, I mean, I would imagine that the king is probably going to wear uniform and then will have his robes over that, but it'll be interesting to see. And I think that's the other thing about the coronation. Yes, you've got this sort of, this artery of history running through it, but it has to also move with the times. And that's particularly what the king and the palace are very keen to do with this. You know, they're not inviting as many people. Well, I don't think it will be so heavy with, you know, the peerage. And that has been the case in the past. I think they were bringing in different parts of society and just really trying to make it inclusive. So I'm, for one, quite interested to see what happens today and to be able to compare it to what happened over the centuries.
And where do you plan on watching the coronation on May the 6th? Are you hoping to be there in person, or will you be watching on television?
No, I'm not. I think if I could be guaranteed a front row seat, but I'm not prepared to camp out on the pavements. There's so much stuff, you know. I mean, I work at Mary Evans Picture Library. We're a historical archive, and so a lot of the stuff that I write about is inspired by the archive. And a lot of coronation history I can find in the archive. And there are so many accounts by people talking about, basically, you can't, you know, they went to see the coronation, which they would have had to pre-Elizabeth II. If you wanted to see it, you had to go there in person. And, you know, so many of them couldn't see anything. So I have a feeling that might be the case. I'll be watching it at home, mainly because I've got a tight deadline to write this piece about what he's wearing. I've got to file that the next day.
And we mentioned your writing, your book, Royal Coronations. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I actually wrote it a decade ago now, and its time has finally come. But what it is, it's a Shire book. And if any of your listeners are familiar with those, they are small, concise histories on certain subjects. They cover a very, very broad spectrum of different subjects, everything from seaside peers to, I did another one for them on debutantes in the London season. So Royal Coronations, if you want a nice, really sort of concise, potted history of coronations, that's what it is. There are other books out, but they are quite hefty tomes, and mine kind of takes all the important bits and puts it in there. And it's also, you know, very heavily illustrated with images from Mary Evans as well.
Lovely. And where's the best place to find that?
I think you can find it on Amazon. It's also available in quite a lot of sort of, you know, heritage bookshops. You probably get it in, you know, the Westminster Abbey shop, that those sort of places.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look forward to the big day on May the 6th. Author and historian Lucinda Gosling, thanks for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks very much.
And thanks to Howell Davies. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Coming up, some books by and about King Charles. And I'll chat to Lady-in-Waiting, Lady Glenconner, about her life in the shadow of the crown. That's all to come after this.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. Some of the feedback received by the Talking Book Studios over the years can be a bit unusual.
We get a lot of fan letters from our readers. We get a lot of thanks from our readers as well, which is really lovely to hear. I remember one story. One gentleman wrote to us, complained about the books we were sending him. We used to put a little asterisk by the catalogue number when there was a warning put onto the book, you know, warnings that there was bad language or some passages that may not be considered suitable for family listening. So we used to put a little warning on it on the recording, and we used to put a little asterisk by the print catalogue so people, if they saw that, they could say, well, I don't want to listen to that. And we had one gentleman write to us and say, I'm disgusted. Every single book you send me, from beginning to end, it's full of filth. Now, you do notice what I've said there, from beginning to end. So he read the book first, then decided to complain about it. What we discovered lately is that he wasn't selecting the books, his carer was selecting the books, and she thought these asterisks were books that we were recommending.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999, or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999, or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community, from remote banking to TV remotes, call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
Books written by King Charles III, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Harmony, a new way of looking at our world. Long before the phrase climate change was a universal catchphrase, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales was studying the impact of industrialisation on the environment. In this cross-disciplinary work, the then Prince of Wales called upon his years of research and explored the way in which mankind must work to restore the delicate balance with nature that we've lost in the centuries since the Industrial Revolution began.
Before we begin our journey, there are a number of key words and terms that I will use throughout that I feel I should explain. One of these terms is mechanistic thinking. This stems from what happened in Western thought from the 17th century onwards, after the great pioneers of empirical discovery like Descartes and Francis Bacon laid down the principles of the scientific revolution. Nature began to be understood in the more clinical terms of its mechanics, as we shall see. This is because, in the main, our science has been based on a reductionist approach. Organisms are broken down and their separate parts are studied in mechanical terms. Hence, in schools today, children are generally taught to see the human heart as nothing more than a pump, the lungs as a set of bellows, and the brain as some sort of very clever computer, with the human mind conveniently explained away as the product of an electromagnetic effect of brain function. Despite the incredible leaps that quantum mechanics and particle physics and the lessons on the interconnectivity of matter they so readily offer us, it still appears odd that many people seem not to have a knowledge of these things. Is this perhaps why things start to get a bit fuzzy in the schoolroom when it comes to defining consciousness in mechanistic terms, or, for that matter, the imagination? Quite where the resonance we feel for the beauty of things, or ultimately love, comes from is anybody's guess.
Harmony, A New Way of Looking at Our World, was narrated by the then HRH, the Prince of Wales, and runs for 11 hours and 21 minutes. Our second book, written by King Charles III, A Vision of Britain, Personal View of Architecture. The book that accompanied the then Prince Charles's first television documentary. He stresses the need to preserve our towns and cities, the need to review the planning laws, and the importance of providing what people want on a human scale.
We must respect the land. It is our birthright, and almost every inch of it is densely layered with our island history. The landscape is the setting for all our architecture. In the United Kingdom, we are blessed with an enormous variety of landscape. Such richness, from the hills of Derbyshire and the Yorkshire Dales to the level fens of Lincolnshire, is greatly to be treasured. Often the type of land is gentle and subtle, and correspondingly delicate and easily damaged. Much has been damaged. The last war didn't help in this respect. But it can be restored if people are prepared to take the time and trouble. New buildings can be intrusive, or they can be designed and sited so that they fit in. It is seldom enough to disguise them by planting. The scale and nature of the new buildings are crucial. Rather than planning from a drawing board or plotting road routes on a map, we should feel the lie of the land and its contours, and respect them as a result. New buildings shouldn't dominate the landscape, but blend carefully with it. Often large buildings can be separated into elements which will humanize the scale, give a gentler skyline, and enhance the picturesque quality of our landscape. We must protect the land. We need, for all sorts of complex historical and psychological reasons, to keep a sense of wilderness. The green belts are a valuable contribution to the preservation, even if sometimes this is an illusion, of the countryside. If new buildings avoid sprawl and are grouped together, more of the landscape can be preserved. There's no point, as I see it, in having green belts unless they are genuinely green. It would help in a small island to avoid the wirescape, the spread of sodium lighting, the rash of badly designed supermarkets and petrol stations, and the fields full of parked cars. Farms and many government buildings and structures such as army camps and power stations may be immune from planning laws, but they should not be immune from aesthetic considerations. They, above all, should respect the land.
A Vision of Britain, A Personal View of Architecture by the Prince of Wales is narrated by Peter Wickham, and it runs for 2 hours and 26 minutes. And our third book isn't written by King Charles III, although it does feature quite heavily. Spare by Prince Harry. It was one of the most searing images of the 20th century. Two young boys, two princes, walking behind their mother's coffin as the world watched in sorrow and horror. As Diana, Prince of Wales, was laid to rest, billions wondered what the princes must be thinking and feeling, and how their lives would play out from that point on. For Harry, this is that story at last. With its raw, unflinching honesty, Spare is a landmark publication full of insight, revelation, self-examination, and hard-won wisdom about the eternal power of love over grief.
I forgot who used the word first. Someone in the press, probably. Or one of my teachers. Whoever it took hold and circulated. I'd been cast in my role in the rolling royal melodrama. Long before I was old enough to drink a beer, legally, it became dogma. Harry? Yeah, he's the naughty one. Naughty became the tide I swam against, the headwind I flew against, the daily expectation I could never hope to shake. I didn't want to be naughty. I wanted it to be noble. I wanted it to be good. Work hard, grow up, and do something meaningful with my days. But every sin, every misstep, every setback triggered the same tired label and the same public condemnations, and thereby reinforced the conventional wisdom that I was innately naughty. Things might have been different if I'd achieved good grades, but I didn't, and everyone knew it. My reports were in the public domain. The whole Commonwealth was aware of my academic struggles, which were largely due to being overmatched at Eton. But no one ever discussed the other probable cause. Mummy. Study, concentration, requires an alliance with the mind. And in my teen years, I was waging all-out war with mine. I was forever fending off its darkest thoughts, its basest fears, its fondest memories. The fonder the memory, the deeper the ache. I'd found strategies for doing this, some healthy, some not, but all quite effective. And whenever they were unavailable, for instance, when I was forced to sit quietly with a book, I freaked out. Naturally, I avoided such situations. At all costs, I avoided sitting quietly with a book.
Spare is narrated by Prince Harry and runs for 15 hours, 39 minutes. For more information about these royal books and well over 30,000 other titles of fiction and non-fiction, head to rniblibrary.com or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 and ask about Talking Books. Lady in Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown, is a memoir of drama, tragedy and royal secrets by Anne Glenconner, a close member of the royal circle and lady-in-waiting to Prince Margaret. She has been at the centre of the royal circle from childhood, when she met and befriended the future Queen Elizabeth II and her sister, the Princess Margaret. Though the firstborn child of the 5th Earl of Leicester, who controlled one of the largest estates in England, as a daughter she was deemed the greatest disappointment and unable to inherit. Since then, she has needed all her resilience to survive court life with her sense of humour intact. A unique witness to landmark moments in royal history, Lady in Waiting is written and narrated by Anne Glenconner.
One morning at the beginning of 2019, when I was in my London flat, the telephone rang. Hello. Lady Glenconner, it's Helena Bonham Carter. It's not every day a Hollywood film star rings me up, although I had been expecting her call. When the producers of the popular Netflix series The Crown contacted me, saying that I was going to be portrayed by Nancy Carroll in the third series, and that Helena Bonham Carter had been cast as Princess Margaret, I was delighted. Asked whether I minded meeting them so they could get a better idea of my friendship with Princess Margaret, I said I didn't mind in the least. Nancy Carroll came to tea, and we sat in armchairs in my sitting room and talked. The conversation was surreal, as I became extremely self-aware, realising that Nancy must be absorbing what I was like. I was asked to write a book when I was 87, and I said, well, I can't possibly do that. I'm far too old. So they said, oh, well, dictate it. Sit and just dictate it. And it worked very, very well, because I've sold nearly a million copies. It's been translated into 14 different languages, and I'm going to be 90 this summer. So it's never too late to, you know. I feel extremely lucky to be in this position. And I'm delighted to be in Scotland for the Boswell Literary Festival at Dumfries House. Heard so much about it. And we went yesterday to see the Wall Garden, which I thought was completely magical.
Now, what I think is remarkable is you narrated the audio version of the book yourself.
Oh, yes, well, I did. My great friend is Rupert Everett, the actor, and I said I was going to read it. And he said, no, Anne, that would be too difficult, it's too exhausting, which made me absolutely determined that I would do it. But I did have one of the sort of unexpected things, my tongue swelled up. I talked every day for about 5 hours. So I had to suck cubes of ice. Anyway, I did it, and I think a lot of people have liked it and have said, you know, that because I read it, it means much more to people. My earliest memories of Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret came from when I was 2 or 3 years old. Princess Elizabeth 5 years older, which was quite a lot. She's rather grown up. But Princess Margaret was only 3 years older, and we became firm friends. She was naughty, funny, and imaginative, the very best sort of friend to have. We used to rush round Holkham, past the grand pictures, whirling through the labyrinth of corridors on our trikes, or jumping out at the nursery footmen as they carried huge silver trays from the kitchen. Princess Elizabeth was much better behaved. "Please don't do that, Margaret," or "You shouldn't do that, Anne," she would scold us. In one photograph, we are all standing in a line. Princess Elizabeth is frowning at Princess Margaret, suspecting she's up to no good, while Princess Margaret is staring down at my shoes. Years afterwards, I show Princess Margaret the photo and ask, "Ma'am, why were you looking at my feet?" And she replied, "Well, I'm so jealous because you had silver shoes and I had brown ones."
And of course, you're in the public eye at the moment because you were depicted in The Crown. Did you watch it?
Well, I didn't actually watch Crown. I did watch the bit I was in. I couldn't resist. It was absolute rubbish, really, but quite fun. I don't think the royal family watched it. I must say, I don't blame them. But actually, when it first started, being one of the maids of honour, we had a special showing, and that was rather good. I think it started off rather well, and then I think it's gone completely off-piste at the moment. The bit I was in, I hoped that it would be filmed, because my husband's family home is in Peeblesham, the Glen, just above Traquair, and I rather hope they might film it there, but I think that that was probably too expensive. So they filmed it in the really grotty country club, and I'm sitting by a pool, Princess Margaret and me, in sort of bikinis, and I'm sort of pimping for her. I'm saying, "Look, ma'am, do you like that young man over there? Hasn't he got a cute bottom?" You know, I mean, complete rubbish. I'm so glad that darling Princess Margaret is no longer, and so she wasn't able to see it with me, because it would have been very, very embarrassing.
Lady in Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown by Anne Glenconner is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. Some royal history books to listen to around the time of King Charles III's coronation. First, The Trial of Charles I by C.V. Wedgwood. In 10 weeks, Cromwell's men defeated the king, tried and executed him, and proclaimed a republic. This is a new interpretation by a master of historical narrative of the events and personalities of one of the most dramatic stories of English political history.
The English nation are a sober people, however at present infatuated, King Charles had written from Newport to his son. They were not so infatuated as to be unable to mock at their plight. One of the most popular ballads in London at the time was a string of doggerel verses deriding the idea of majority rule, the conflicting claims of the sects, and the rumours about the fate of the king. "Now, thanks to the powers below, we have even done our due. The mitre is down, and so is the crown, and with them the coronet too. There is no such thing as a bishop or a king, or peer, but in name or show. Come clowns and come boys, come hobbledehoys, come females of each degree. Stretch out your throats, bringing in your votes, and make good the anarchy. We are 80 religions strong, then take your choice, the major voice shall carry it, right or wrong. Then let's have King Charles," says George. "Nay, we'll have his son," says Hugh. "Nay, then let's have none," says jabbering Joan. "Nay, we'll all be kings," says Prue. But ballads and gaiety were declining, not merely because of the Puritan triumph. A foreign visitor who returned to England after the civil wars found that the people, whom he remembered as friendly and good-humoured, had become melancholy, spiteful, as if bewitched. they had cause for gloom. There had been no settled government for over 6 years. Taxation to pay for the war had been introduced by Parliament in 1643 on a nationwide basis and had continued ever since. The hated excise, a purchase tax, enhanced the price of most essential goods, while every household in the country had to contribute to the so-called weekly assessment to pay the running expenses of the war. The king's adherents, from the highest almost to the lowest, had had to compound, or in other words, to pay fines, which were somewhat arbitrarily calculated in relation to their resources and the extent to which they had actively participated in the fighting.
The Trial of Charles I by C.V. Wedgwood is narrated by Andrew Gemmell and lasts 8 hours 50 minutes. Our second book and our second Charles, King Charles II by Antonia Fraser. The life story of possibly the best loved of all English monarchs. From his youth, being born to reconcile the divided world, on through the execution of his father in exile, to the restoration and many enigmas of his reign.
A quote from the Eve of Coronation address to Charles II in 1661. Great sir, the star which at your happy birth joyed with his beams at noon the wandering earth, did with auspicious lustre then presage the glittering plenty of this golden age. At Dover, on the 25th of May, 1660, the flags waved, the trumpets blew, and high above the heads of the crowd, vast indications of new glories could be seen, the royal arms publicly flaunted in joy. On the sea voyage, however, the king himself deliberately turned his thoughts back to the past. He was, as usual, physically active and stirring, striding up and down the deck. But his conversation was of old times. He talked, almost gossiped, of that flight after Worcester. It was a significant recitation, for the king was speaking not so much to Samuel Pepys, making notes at his side, as to himself. This king, who was about to be restored, never intended to let himself forget what he had endured, and might one day have to endure again. Thus he dwelt consciously on the nadir of his fortunes, where other men might have been puffed up with contemplation of the future. Not that life on board was all retrospection. Before they sailed, there had been pleasanter diversions, such as the renaming of the royal ships, to rescue them from their unpleasant protectoral nomenclature. This probably took place on the quarter-deck table under the awning. Thus the Richard, Cromwell, became the James, Duke of York. The Speaker of the House of Commons became the Mary, Princess of Orange. And the Dunbar, oh, hateful Scottish word, the Henry for the Duke of Gloucester. Pepys, like many of those suddenly enjoying intimate contact with royalty, allowed himself to be charmed by such evidence of the king's humanity as the fact that his dogs were busy making messes on the deck, just like any other dogs. Finally, at the king's suggestion, the three royal brothers, Charles, James, and Henry, tucked into a seaman's breakfast of pork, peas, and boiled beef.
King Charles II by Antonia Fraser is narrated by John Westbrook and runs for 25 hours 48 minutes. Our final royal historical book, Crown and Country by David Starkey. The monarchy is one of Britain's longest surviving institutions, as well as one of its most tumultuous and revered. David Starkey looks at the monarchy as a whole, charting its history from Roman times to the War of the Roses, the chaos of the Civil War, the fall of Charles I and Cromwell's emergence as Lord Protector, all the way up to the Victorian era when Britain's monarchs came face to face with modernity.
One of William's first acts in England had been to build a castle to secure his camp at Hastings,
The scene is vividly represented in the Bayeux Tapestry. William sits in council with his two half-brothers, Bishop Odo and Robert, Count of Mortain. The latter issues the order to build the castle. Workmen with picks and shovels throw up the pudding-shaped motte, or mound, which is crowned with a wooded stockade. The motte was one essential feature of the castle. The other was the bailey, or stockaded enclosure, at the foot of the motte. These motte and bailey castles, like the mounted knights and archers which had won Hastings, were another mark of the Normans' military superiority. They were standardised, quick and easy to build, using forced labour and the plentiful supplies of local timber, and above all, they were effective. On his march to London, after the Battle of Hastings, William strengthened the fortifications of Dover, and from his residence at Barking, he used the first weeks of 1067 to supervise the construction of another castle at London, to the southeast of the city, on the site of the present tower. William's first two English castles at Hastings and Dover were designed to secure his communications with Normandy. His third, at London, was intended to overawe the capital city. Now, Odo, from his base at Dover, and Robert, from his at Norwich, were building more. Anglo-Saxon England had seen nothing like them. The burhs, or fortified towns, were designed to protect the people. The motte and bailey castles were there to intimidate them. And they did. With their raw earth and wood set in a tree-denuded landscape, each was the symbol of a profoundly alien military occupation.
Crown and Country by David Starkey is narrated by Tim Pigott-Smith and runs for 15 hours and 12 minutes. For more information about these royal books and well over 30,000 other titles of fiction and non-fiction, head to rniblibrary.com or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 and ask about talking books. That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rniblconnectradio.org.uk.